I should first like to thank the organizers for the invitation to speak, and then maybe second apologize to the organizers for not talking about Hamiltonian systems. But in my defense, although I'll be talking about a topic that comes up in the study of dissipative PDEs, the techniques I'll use are techniques that I think first arose in the study of finite dimensional Hamiltonian systems, actually. So that's some connection to the subject of this meeting. So that's my justification. So what I actually want to tell you about today is some very recent joint work with Carsten Matthias from the Free University in Berlin. And so we were interested in the following problem. I'll explain in more detail what some of these terms mean as we go through. But one can have a situation, if you study traveling waves, in which if you look at a homogeneous medium, you see a traveling wave, but if that medium has small-scale structure, the traveling waves can get stuck or pinned to the inhomogeneities. And so rather than having a traveling wave, you have a standing wave. And so these standing waves have been proposed as, the uses have been proposed for these types of standing solutions and various biological and physical systems. And so what Karsten and I set out to try and understand is how common these things are. Are they really very, very common phenomena in these types of partial differential equations, or are they somewhat more special? And what I'll show is, at least in the class of equations we've been studying, they're very special in the sense that they can occur only for very small ranges of parameters. Okay? So, and as I say, I'll amplify on those remarks as we go through the talk. So, since this is somewhat distant from the topics of the workshop, let me give at least a brief introduction. So what we're going to be interested in are traveling waves or traveling fronts. And so these have a quite long history, going back at least to the work of Kolmogorov and his collaborators in the 1930s. So suppose one looks at some partial differential equation of the type I've written here at the top of the transparency, then very often one is interested in special classes of solutions, say traveling waves or fronts. So we did hear about those in the context of water waves this morning, so people have been exposed to that in at least one talk already. So if you start from an equation of this type, which comes up in many different circumstances, I've listed just a few of them here on the transparency, and you make the hypothesis that you're interested particularly in solutions that have a fixed shape, phi, and travel with a constant speed, then you can make the hypothesis that the solution has this form, plug this back into the equation, and then you'll get, depending on the dimension you're in, either an ordinary differential equation or a partial differential equation in fewer variables for the function phi. And then you can perhaps apply ideas from dynamical systems to show that the ordinary differential equation for the profile of the wave or the front has a solution. Okay. Now, so I say these types of equations come up in many different circumstances, and here I have written the example in such a way as to imply that the coefficients in the equation and the nonlinearity don't depend on the independent variables x and t, and that's very often appropriate. So, but maybe not always. And so I just want to give you two examples coming from biology which sort of illustrate opposite extremes of this situation. So so one example has to do with the propagation of electrical impulses in neurons. So so sort of all I know about biology is on this slide, so don't ask me about that. But a neuron, I guess, it has this central cell body, and then sticking out from it are these things which are called axons, and these axons sort of go and touch or almost touch other axons, and the way these neurons communicate is that they'll send an electrical impulse down one of these axons to the next neuron, and it seems that a reasonably good, though very much simplified, model for the propagation of pulses down one of these axons is what's known as the Fitch-Unigumo equation. And because these axons are very long in comparison with their diameter, and because their properties are relatively uniform throughout the axon, it is a good approximation to assume that, as I've indicated here in this general equation right here, that the coefficients and the nonlinear terms in the equation are independent of the independent variables x and t. Now, another situation in your body where you see these sorts of traveling waves is in your heart. There are sort of waves of electrical activity that propagate through the heart tissue. In fact, I found a nice picture on Jim Keener's webpage. So this is somebody or something's heart. I don't know if it's a person or not. And this is an actual picture of the electrical activity propagating across this heart. Okay, so I think this is something not very good happening to the heart, actually. So, what I want to just point out here is that you can see, you know, the heart is also made up of many, many cells, and the size of the cells in your heart are very much smaller than the typical length scale of this traveling pulse. So this is a situation in which probably a model of this type, in which the coefficients in the equation are constants, is probably not very good, but you would expect some variation in the coefficients of the equation on a scale much smaller than the typical size of the traveling wave. Okay? Another case in which these sorts of inhomogeneities arise quite naturally are in combustion problems. If you have a flame propagating through, say, a liquid of some type, then the heating of the liquid will cause the fluid to move. And so, again, in that case, in the heart, you know, the arrangement of the cells is very regular, and so you might expect that the coefficients would vary in a periodic fashion. In these types of combustion problems, it's more natural to consider sort of coefficients that vary randomly due to the turbulent motion of the underlying fluid. But there again is a situation in which it's very natural to consider traveling waves in heterogeneous, in PDEs with heterogeneous coefficients. And even questions of existence of traveling waves in such problems is very much more complicated than in the homogeneous case, and very much less well understood, I should say. And just if you want to know sort of what the state of the art is at the moment, I sort of heartily recommend this review article by Jack Shin, which appeared last year in the SIAM review. Okay. One phenomenon that was recognized relatively early is that if you have small-scale structures in the coefficients of the PDE, then these traveling waves can get stuck. Okay, so you can have situations where in a homogeneous problem you would have a traveling wave moving with some spot positive speed c, but when you introduce these small-scale structures, the wave stops and you get a standing solution, but with non-trivial spatial structure. Okay. And these types of solutions have sort of generated a fair amount of interest, particularly in biology. You can imagine that, you know, if you think of now a model for sort of neural tissue, lots of neurons, not a single neuron like we modeled here with the Fitch-Unigumo equation, but say your brain, then you could imagine that having a solution of some model of lots of neurons coupled together in which you had a localized stationary region of electrical activity could, you know, be used to model memory or things like that. Okay, so people have been sort of interested in these penned solutions in various circumstances, but particularly in biology. And so as I say, what Karsten and I set out to look at was whether or not these things, so there are examples where they occur, but we just wondered, are they typical somehow, okay? And so by the way, I should have said another example in which these arise quite naturally is propagation through layered materials, okay? If you have some material made up of two different substances layered together, then again, you're going to get periodic variation in the coefficients in the PDE that describes it. So we're going to consider a strip which is sort of unbounded in the horizontal direction and then has some, in our case, is a rectangular cross-section. And we're going to look at some partial differential equation of the type I described earlier, of the sort of general form that I wrote down earlier, but now we'll look explicitly at the situation in which the coefficients in the problem, d0 and d1, vary periodically in the unbounded direction and on a scale epsilon, which will be small in comparison with the typical size over which the front varies, and will also allow the nonlinear term in the equation to depend on this fast variable as well. Okay? And then lambda you should think of as some time kind of external parameter in your system, so that lambda is at your disposal to vary. Okay? And now the question we want to answer is, suppose you know that this equation has one of these standing wave solutions at some value lambda equals lambda naught. Does that solution persist over a large range of parameters? You start to vary lambda now. Are you still going to have this Penn solution, or will it go away? And the answer is that, in fact, it persists only for a very, very small range of parameters, at least if epsilon is small. If your variations in your system occur over a small length scale epsilon, then the size of the parameter interval over which this Penn wave can persist is exponentially small in epsilon. Okay, so now I should give a few more details. There are obviously some hypotheses that go into this, so let me just describe in a bit more detail what the hypotheses of the theorem are. So we're interested specifically in penned solutions, stationary solutions, so I'll just set the right-hand or the left-hand side of the equation equal to zero. Once I do that, and since I'm going to assume that my diffusion coefficients are everywhere positive, I can divide through by d0 of y over epsilon, and then I just have this sort of elliptic equation that I've called equation star here. Absolutely. No, that's the part. No, that's the part where I've got to be a little more honest, and we'll be here in a moment. So what I'm going to show is, well, sorry. So this will appear on the next transparency, I think. But since you brought it up, there's a fixed constant c independent of epsilon, such that any other standing wave with lambda with a parameter lambda within a distance c of lambda zero actually has to be exponentially close to lambda zero. So, yeah. So you could have different bifurcation branches, so to speak. Okay. So, these are periodic. So the d is let's say it doesn't have to be very smooth, but at least let's say c1 function that varies periodically. And so let's say d has period one, so that the rescaled d has period epsilon. So I'm going to look for solutions of equation star, and the idea is that we'll think of this unbounded variable y as a time variable, and then ask ourselves whether, using ideas from dynamical systems, we can construct some bounded trajectory or bounded orbit, again, thinking of y as time, for this dynamical system star. And so, I guess this probably is a non-autonomous Hamiltonian system, so maybe. But that will play absolutely no role in anything that happens here today. Now, the ideas that Carsten and I use sort of combine dynamical systems ideas with a little bit of homogenization theory. So we're actually going to compare this equation star with an averaged or homogenized equation. Okay, so I have another equation, star star, in which the coefficients are independent of the time variable y. Okay, so d bar now is just a constant. I'll tell you its value in a moment, and you'll see it's somehow related to homogenization theory. F bar is just the average of our original nonlinear term over one period of the fast variable theta. And so now we have an equation much more in the spirit of the original equations of KPP and people like that that I wrote down before, in which the coefficients are now independent of the unbounded spatial variable. Okay. Now, just some technical points. We're going to assume that F is very smooth. So in particular, analytic in U and X. Okay. And we're going to assume that we know something about this averaged equation. Namely, we're going to assume that the averaged equation has a penned solution when lambda is equal to lambda naught and epsilon is equal to zero. And we're going to assume that we know something about the limits of that penned solution at infinity. Okay. That they approach some constant state at plus or minus infinity. So this would, if U plus and U minus are different, as they will be in all the examples I know, then these are what are typically called fronts in the... Sorry? Well, let's see. All we assume is that F is a sort of C1 function of lambda, and F and its derivatives with respect to X and U depend C1 on lambda. But other than that, it's completely arbitrary. An example you might think of is you could have an example in which, say, F bar of U was U times U minus. I want to think of an example where F is basically quadratic and we have a root here at lambda, say, something like that. So I guess U minus lambda, U minus 1 or something like that. Okay, so if I've got the signs right. So that would be one way, but it basically just any C1 dependence on lambda would be okay. Yep. Yeah, so please do interrupt if there are points that are not clear. So. They're constant solutions of my averaged PDE. So independent of y. Sorry. Yeah. So in this case, for instance, you could take U equals 0 and U equal 1. So if that were our average form. Okay. And so the next hypothesis is that, again, if you're familiar with... Yes. Yes. So that's right. So I'm thinking of, in dynamical systems language, I want to find a heteroclinic orbit of this dynamical system. Okay. Sort of, yeah. Okay. Well, okay. So, that's right. So, fair enough. This equation is certainly quite Hamiltonian. So I'm back in the workshop. Okay. So, okay. Now, those of you who've thought about traveling waves know or may remember that there's this distinction between the monostable and bistable case. So we're going to be in the bistable case. If you don't know what that is, I can say mathematically, it simply means that if you look at this equation linearized about the asymptotic states at plus and minus infinity, this linearized operator is strictly positive. Okay, so that's a mathematical formulation. And as I say, for people who think about traveling waves, all I'm saying is we're in the bistable case. And finally, unfortunately, most technical hypotheses, we need some kind of non-degeneracy condition. And so that we phrase as follows. So let me rewrite this equation star star as a system, a first order system. So I'll introduce capital U, which will just be U and U sub Y, and then I can immediately rewrite star star as star star star. And it's of this form where I've written down A bar and F bar. So by this assumption that our average equation has a penned solution, then we know that star 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 has a penned solution, so a heteroclinic solution, if you like. And I'm going to, as I say, things are getting So things will get progressively more technical for two more transparencies, and then they'll get less technical again. Okay. So I'm going to regard star, star, star as a dynamical system on this function space H S cross H S minus 1. And so the non-degeneracy condition I have to assume, or maybe not have to, but the non-degeneracy condition we do assume because we don't know how to do it with anything weaker than this, is that if you linearize about the stationary state for this equation, then obviously, because this equation is translation invariant and y, you're always going to have one zero eigenvalue of the linearization coming from translation invariance. So the first assumption we make is that that's the only zero eigenvalue. The only zero eigenvalue of the linearization comes from the translation invariance. There's no spurious zero eigenvalues. And the second assumption we make is that we can move out of that, the zero eigenspace by varying the parameter. So this is non-degeneracy condition on what happens when you differentiate with respect to lambda. So those are our non-degeneracy conditions. Okay, so now I think I've sort of been pretty honest in telling you what we assume, and so now let me be pretty honest in telling you what we can prove. So let's assume we have star and star, star, star. So remember, star is our original problem with the time-dependent or spatial, the dependence on the fast variation with respect to y, our unbounded or temporal variable, and star, star, star is our averaged equation. So let's suppose they satisfy those hypotheses I just told you. Then standing waves can exist only in an exponentially small parameter interval. That is, we have positive constants epsilon 0, c1, c2, and so on and so forth, and some function lambda 1 of epsilon, such that if you take any standing wave, I'm sorry, not of star, 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 but of the original problem, star. So, sorry, I forgot to bring my pens with me. This is, I've got pens right here, so I just forget. So sorry, this is a serious typo. So this is just, so if we have any standing wave of our original equation, that is to say the spatially varying problem, u tilde lambda tilde, that is within some fixed distance of the standing wave of the parameter of the average problem, and whose parameter value is within some fixed distance of the parameter value for the homogenized problem. And again, note that these distances don't depend on epsilon, so these are just some fixed neighborhoods. Then, in fact, the parameter value of the standing wave for the original problem is within some exponentially small neighborhood of this function, lambda 1 of epsilon. Okay. So let me now draw a picture to sort of try and illustrate what we've got here. Maybe I'll put it over here. So if you like, there's a sort of bifurcation diagram of the following sort. Suppose you're here in the epsilon lambda plane, okay? So you've got this value lambda zero of the parameter for which you know that the homogenized problem has a Penn solution. And then you've got some fixed neighborhood, lambda 0 minus C2 and lambda 0 plus C2 in the lambda axis. And you've got some curve, lambda 1 of epsilon, bifurcating from lambda 0. Then any other Penn solution of this problem must live in this very narrow little funnel about our bifurcation curve, lambda 1 of epsilon. Okay, so that's the only place these Penn solutions can occur, unless they're far away. Okay. Yes. Yes, exactly. So just to jump ahead, we're going to perform an exponential averaging on this equation, and lambda 1 of epsilon will be a curve of solutions for the averaged equation. Yeah. So that's its physical meaning. Okay. Okay. So maybe this is a good point to pause for questions. Okay. Yeah. Jim. Well, yes and no, because you see, U bar, if you look back to the equation that U bar satisfies, its coefficients, I didn't tell you what the coefficients were there exactly, and so they actually come from a homogenization procedure, and so their coefficients are sort of different than what you would get if you just naively plunked them equal to constants, and so that's the sense in which this is related to the original problem. But you're quite right, that's been obscured by the way I stated the theorem. Yeah, it's a very good point. Yeah. So. Other questions? Okay, so there are basically three steps of the proof, and I'll maybe tell you about two of them. There's a sort of homogenization step, which we use to treat the linear part of the equation. Then there's a persistence step, which is basically sort of functional analysis, not so much dynamical systems, and so I won't talk about that. And then there's the exponential averaging step, and so if time permits, I'll also say something about that. So I'll try to say something about points one and two. So homogenization is maybe too fancy a name for what we do. We really just change variables. But we're going to make two changes of variables. We're going to reparameterize the time. So remember why this unbounded direction we're thinking of as some kind of temporal variable. So to reinforce that, I'll call it tau now. But I'll also allow it to vary. So I'm going to make some change of variables. And then I'm also going to make a linear transformation of the dependent variable u. I'm going to take u and replace it by some phi tilde. Phi tilde will also depend on this fast time, tau over epsilon. Okay, and then my new dependent variable will be v. It turns out we tried sort of very general forms for phi tilde. It turns out you can get by with a relatively simple form in the end. Okay, that's just how it works. And if you then do the algebra, you just make these changes of variables in the equation, you find that the equation for the new dependent variable as a function of the new temporal variable tau looks as follows. Okay, so it's a big mess. But basically, what I want to do is we've got in the linear part stuff that is at least formally order one, which is the v2, which is pretty harmless, and then this stuff, which depends on the fast time dependence. And I want in particular to eliminate the fast time dependence. And then you've got all this stuff that's at least formally of higher order, okay, which we're going to ignore for the moment. And then you've got the nonlinear term, which we'll deal with down here in part three. Okay. Okay. So, sure. Absolutely. In the transverse. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So you could certainly also, it would be okay to look at an equation like. Sorry. So this would also be okay. Is that the question? Or yeah, that would also be okay. Turns out you can still do it with this kind of change of variable, oddly enough. Yeah. So when you write it in a system, yeah. So okay. I mean, I can show you that. So yeah. Okay. Okay. So let's first. Sorry. Basically. Yeah. That's more or less the answer. So. Sorry?
So if you are saying, oh, okay, in X direction,
Exactly, exactly. The variation is occurring, and that's actually quite consistent with many of the situations, particularly in biology, that people are interested in. I think it's better to leave that until afterwards, okay? Okay, so let's get rid of the red term first. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to define my function theta. So I didn't fix it yet. It's still at my disposal. So I'll define it, define the function theta to satisfy that equation. So it's a little exercise, which I'll leave to the audience, to show that there is a periodic function theta with, there's another typo, zero average. Okay, you can find a periodic function with zero average that satisfies this differential equation. And if you do that, you find that the d bar, the quote-unquote homogenized diffusion coefficient, is just given by this expression. And in particular, you see that this diffusion coefficient d0 that corresponds to the change in the medium as you go in the long direction, you get this 1 over d0 psi average, sort of quite reminiscent of homogenization. Okay, and then the other thing you want to get rid of, is this purple term right here, but that's easy now. You just choose phi equals theta. Okay, and if you make those changes of variables, then the linear part of the problem looks quite a lot better. So I was going to call this star, 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 but I decided H would be easier. So so we now have the equation written in the form dV by dt is now A bar, where A bar is no longer dependent on the fast time, tau over epsilon, F bar, an average nonlinear term, which is also not dependent on the fast time. So these first two terms on the right-hand side of the equation no longer depend on the fast time. And then we've got these two terms, which unfortunately still do depend on the fast time, tau over epsilon. So I'm dV by d tau, sorry. Yeah. D tau. Thank you. So why do we sort of hope that these may be okay? Well, B, you see, has at least one factor of epsilon sitting out in front of it. Now, it's unbounded because it has these Laplacians sitting in there. So we've got to deal with that in a later stage of the argument. But at least formally, it's of order epsilon. And F tilde, you can check, has the property that if you average it over one period of the fast time, then it's order epsilon. So it's going to be small on average, maybe not in a pointwise sense, but at least small on average. Okay, so that's the progress. So now we've sort of dealt with the linear part of the equation, and now we want to do averaging to sort of eliminate these two terms. Okay. So now, unfortunately, there's another little technical interlude here. So to control this operator B, which, as I say, is unbounded, we're going to have to exploit this sort of smoothness here, okay? And so we do that as following. If you look at this operator A, then you can write down explicitly its eigenfunctions, which I've done here, okay? And if you expand an arbitrary function in X, remember X is just HS cross HS minus 1, if you expand an arbitrary function in terms of these basis functions, then you can define a space of analytic functions, I'll call G sub sigma, whose norm is just given by the sum of the squares of the coefficients with respect to these eigenfunctions. There's this factor which is related to the Sobolev norm, and then there's this exponential factor. Okay, so stuff in this space G sigma has Fourier coefficients that decay exponentially fast. So these are analytic functions. Now, that's a sort of natural class to look at, because if you look back at our averaged equation, which was, I think, star, star, it was sort of elliptic, okay? And so you know that its solutions are more or less automatically going to be smooth. So we'll exploit the fact that we have, so to speak, a priori estimate of any Penn solution. You may not know anything about this Penn solution, but you can show without much difficulty that every bounded solution of this equation star star is going to be smooth, okay? And in particular, it will be in these spaces G sub sigma. you could do with less. I mean, the trade-off is as follows. If you have exponentials here, then you get an exponentially small parameter interval. If you just had some large polynomial growth, then you would get an interval that was small as some polynomial in epsilon. So it's the kind of usual trade-off. So, yeah. Okay, so now with this in mind, we can prove an averaging theorem for this problem. So remember, this is our original problem written in after we've made this quote-unquote homogenization. And so the idea is we want to get rid of B and F tilde to the extent that we can. And so the averaging theorem says that you can get rid of them to quite a high degree. It says that there is a change of variables phi of u of the form, it's near identity, so phi of u is u plus epsilon w. This change of variables is analytic and invertible on these spaces of analytic functions that I just defined. And if V is a solution of our homogenized equation, then U satisfies this averaged equation where U just evolves according to A bar times U plus some averaged nonlinearity. And the important thing is that this averaged nonlinearity does not depend on the fast time tau over epsilon. And then there's a remainder term, and this remainder term is exponentially small. Okay. But there's a slightly funny bit about this estimate here. The estimate says that if you assume that U is in one of these spaces of analytic functions, then you can estimate R in the Sobolev norm, X, by this exponentially small parameter. So that doesn't look very good if you want to, you know, you can't sort of obviously evolve the equation or something like that. So it might be a little bit unclear for those of you who've thought about KAM theorems and things like that, or Nikiroshev-type theorems, then it may be a little bit unclear how you'll use this to actually derive information about the original equation. I'll try to explain that. But this averaging theorem, I should say, is very, very close in both spirit and proof to the original results on exponential averaging by Nystad. For Nystad. Okay, so maybe I'm sort of running out of time here. So so maybe what I'll do is just finish by explaining how, from the averaging theorem, we can deduce the main theorem on the sort of exponentially small interval of existence for standing waves. So the first thing we do is this persistence step, which, as I said, that I'm not going to talk about. That's functional analysis. But the idea is as follows. You just consider what happens if you ignore everything, if you just drop the remainder term, R. Okay, so then you just have this averaged equation, and you can show, given our non-degeneracy hypotheses, that this averaged equation does indeed have a standing wave solution, U bar epsilon, that is close to, in fact, within a distance epsilon of the original standing wave solution. Okay, and now we consider any other standing wave for our original problem that is close to the solution of the average problem in the sense I described. Namely, there is some neighborhood of size order one in both U and lambda such that this new standing wave is within that order one neighborhood. Okay. Then U tilde is a solution of this equation, our averaged equation, okay? Or, yeah, the equation after we've done the homogenization and the averaging, okay? And the important thing is that, again, as I said earlier, by these sort of ellipticity results, both U tilde epsilon and U tilde are analytic, so they're in these function spaces G sigma. Okay, that's just kind of an a priori fact. Now,
Yes. Yes.
Let's see. I'm not sure I understand that remark. Let's see. In terms of, sorry, let me not lose my transparency. I mean, are you saying we can move up and down this curve? Is that, yeah, okay, I agree with that. So in fact, we don't prove that. There's a technical point in this persistence result which does not permit us to prove that, because of the fact that the actual equation has this remainder term R, which is unbounded. Okay, so what you say is almost certainly true, but not part of the proof. Okay, so the curve lambda 1 of epsilon is constructed by ignoring the remainder term, and then we show that if the full equation has a solution, it must occur in this parameter window. It probably does, but that's we don't actually prove that. Okay. So now we assume there's a solution. It satisfies this equation. If we write the true solution as the solution of the average problem such plus some perturbation, then you can write out just with a little bit of algebra the equation for V tilde. It satisfies this equation. You linearize about the standing wave of the average problem, and that linearization is equal to this mess right here. Okay? So now we'll recall that thanks to these assumptions about the linearization, the adjoint of this operator L has a single eigenvector in its kernel. Let's call it psi. And so if we take the inner product of both sides of this equation with respect to psi, then we see 0 is equal to psi inner product L V tilde, because you can just throw the L over onto the V and L adjoint psi, or the L over onto the psi, and L adjoint psi is 0. And that's got to be equal to the sum of these two integrals here. So I1 of lambda tilde and I2 of lambda tilde. Now, since we know that U bar plus V tilde is in G sigma, we know that R evaluated on this solution is going to be exponentially small. Okay? So I2 of lambda tilde will be exponentially small for all lambda in some order 1 neighborhood. Okay. So the averaging theorem tells us that I2 is exponentially small. On the other hand, for this equation, since it involves only the exponentially averaged nonlinear term, and we know that when lambda is equal to lambda 1 of epsilon, we have a solution of that problem, I1 will vanish when lambda is equal to lambda 1 of epsilon, and this non-degeneracy condition with respect to derivatives this non-degeneracy condition for derivatives with respect to lambda tell us that the derivative of I1 with respect to lambda is positive. So we see that I1 of lambda tilde is going to be bounded from below by some constant times lambda tilde minus lambda 1. And since I1 plus I2 must sum to 0, that implies that lambda tilde minus lambda 1 has got to be exponentially small. And so that tells us that any solution U tilde lambda tilde that is a standing wave for this problem must occur within this exponentially small neighborhood. That's a good place to stop. Thanks again.